Hello everyone, welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. I'm your host Chris Noyce, and this is the podcast for everything to do with the convenience sector and the issues facing local shops. This is the first of a three-part series featuring live recordings of the panel sessions from this year's Heart of the Community Conference. On this episode, we'll be joining the panel as they talk about the way that food provision is changing in the convenience sector, as well as discussing some of the things that government is looking at when it comes to tackling obesity. All three of the panel sessions on these episodes are being led by our Chief Executive, James Lohman, and this panel is made up of Gary Stott from Community Shop, Anna Taylor from the Food Foundation, Mittal Morar, who's an independent retailer from Manchester, and award-winning broadcaster Ranveer Singh.
We want to talk about food, unpack, sort of a bit of a pun really, isn't it? Because to be unpacked or have packaging free, but I'll unpack some of the issues around food. Mittal, I'm going to start with you. You've been to your fantastic new Stretford Food Hall and to Ancoats General Store. Tell us a bit about your story and particularly how you respond as a business to food trends and to some of these issues in relation to food.
Thank you very much, James. And yes, you did come to Food Hall, and I'm glad you mentioned Food Hall because Food Hall is a huge experiment for us in terms of how we can deliver and mix up what people's expectations on a convenience store are. And I think one of the biggest things that I've had to acknowledge in the last couple of years, really, is that I can't do everything by myself. To explain that sort of thing is we've had restaurants, we've had bars, we've experimented with how we can deliver food to the general public, and obviously as retailers we're governed somewhat by our supply chain, and I've kind of really kicked back with my thoughts on how to use our supply chain and how do we go about pleasing people through the F&B experience that we've had over the number of years. And Food Hall is our latest delivery in terms of what we believe is what people want. So we've obviously experimenting with street food. We collaborate with local makers and people who've got more passion about a specific food item than say I could curate or even try and make up, if you will. Mm-hmm. Coffee. Everyone talks about coffee, but we'd like to think we can do coffee in a speciality way. It's a massive trend. Something that's, people are really digging out and searching for a specialty coffee sort of outlet, really, from your beans to your milk to even to the cups that you serve them, mm-hmm, in, because we're now using local potters to make our cups. We've through Ancoats and into Stretford, we're now moving into refill, which you saw in the video, mm-hmm, refill on liquids and refill on grains and ambient products. And reusing on coffee and with liquids with your household items and wine in particular is something that we're really pushing on. So when you really break down your ambient categories in terms of grocery, I think there's a whole world of opportunity in terms, mm-hmm, of what you can do. I mean, vegan, gluten free, vegetarian is a massive. I don't want to say trend actually, because it's been around for years. It's just really at the forefront now, and I think that you can really go out there and find these products.
Yeah. And what you've done? How does that apply? I mean, neither of your store, those sites are in sort of plush areas necessarily, but nonetheless they've got quite high footfall. How do these sort of area? How do that these sort of challenges? How do you address those if you're on an estate or in a small village or something like that?
Yeah, well, I think we've got a store in Moss Side. I don't know if any of you know Moss Side. I'm sure it has a certain reputation, but equally a really improving reputation as well. And it's got a genuine community. It's got a diverse sort of ethnic clientele, and it's tough to explain to them why they have to firstly pay 5p for a carrier bag, and also what the consequences of, yeah, that particular bag is. It's education, it's expectation. We've moved into a suburb with Stretford, and we've been challenged again with our standards. And we had an aubergine in a plastic thing the other day, and somebody put it on Twitter, and we were exposed in effect. Why is this aubergine in a sure, plastic packet? And it's something we need to fix, yeah, and not allow our supply chain to be doing that really for, absolutely, us. And staff and the systems that we have naturally put that onto the shelf. And the first point I saw it was on Twitter.
Yeah, sure.
So It's an evolving situation constantly.
I want to pick up on some of those packaging points. Really, really interesting part. Gary, a different, a really unique and brilliant story of a company shop, and particularly with a community shop. So a different take on, I suppose, food in the supply chain and food waste, but also providing food into some of the toughest communities. Tell us a bit about what you do.
Great, thanks very much. The Company Shop Group has a pretty long story, which I'm sure nobody's ever heard of. And I'll come right at the end as to why I think that's the reason, what the reason is for that. So about 50 years ago, our chairman, John Maron, took on a little village store in a village called Pilly, outside Barnsley in South Yorkshire, with his mum, S&J Maron Stores, one little shop. Within about 3 weeks, he got tremendously miffed by going to wholesalers who we thought were taking 15% off his margin, and decided to ring around a few factories, see if he could do some direct deals. It's a long time ago. And because he's Yorkshire and tough, it went okay. It was at that point that he realised that when he was going to Carlisle to buy his biscuits, he was seeing a whole host of biscuits in quarantine in retailer-branded packaging. And so John said, what are you doing with those 82 pallets of, let's say, for example, Marks and Spencer's biscuits? And the answer was that we've got to get rid of them because we as the manufacturer still own the product, but we don't own the brand on the packaging. There ain't any way to pull the packaging and the product apart, and therefore to protect the brand and to protect our relationship with the retailer, then they go to waste. John thought that was a shame and started ringing people up and saying, under what circumstances would you grant me permission? Imagine this. Ringing Marks and Spencer's and saying, I've just bought 82 pallets of your biscuits. Under what circumstances will you grant me permission to sell those? You can kind of imagine the answer that came back.
Two words, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that conversation, John will often say, I was a bit persistent because I kept ringing them for 22 years. And I think that shows the change across the industry. Permission was granted, and now the Company Shop Group has about 20 UK locations with 850 staff who sell 70 million units of supply chain surplus that we've purchased. We've given a financial return to manufacturers who would otherwise be having a cost to get rid of that surplus, and we supply about 250,000 people who work in the supply chain in staff-only shops. So closed membership, not the general public can get in. If you work in those factories that manufacture that product or in some of our off-site stores, if you've got a membership card because you work in the supply chain, we'll run your staff shop for you. So about 7 years ago, John came to me and said, it seems to me that there's a million people going to food banks, and it seems to me that there's about 860,000 tonnes of surplus in the manufacturing part of the supply chain, 840,000 in the retail part of the supply chain. That's probably about a million tonnes of surplus that's still going to waste. Why don't we stop thinking of it as waste and just food that ended up in the wrong place? And can we innovate around repurposing that so that we can bring some dignity to the transaction for our lowest income communities, create a food ladder for people to be able to climb back up from a place of dependency? So we spent a year looking at global models and began in Goldthorpe in South Yorkshire, the first community shop, which is dead simple, standard convenience store, using that product range from the Company Shop Group. Learning and development hub where we run 11 different programs around mentoring and supporting people to find the best version of themselves and get out of those situations that brought them in the first place, and a community kitchen and cookery school where people learn again to enjoy food rather than it being a symbol of struggle and strife. We rolled that out in South Yorkshire, 200 yards down the road from an Asda store. So again, we had another conversation that said, you know, you've trusted us for 24 years to discreetly dispose of this surplus in a membership-only network in factory shops. We've now found a retail unit on a high street 200 yards from your front door, and we want to sell your branded stock at 30% of the retail price. How are you fixed? And actually, Andy Clark, who was at Asda at the time, said, you know, we're fixed really well. We've got to come to an accommodation so that it doesn't fracture the local economy or have any negative unintended consequences. But we think that dignified, way of allowing people to access deeply discounted food whilst at the same time working with them on a tailored mentoring programme to help them escape. So we've 4 shops now, 2 opening, 2 in Yorkshire, 1 in Lambeth, 1 in Grimsby, 2 opening in the Liverpool City region. Last year we served 17,000 households, members of households, with about 30 million meals. But lots of good stuff as well.
That's brilliant.
500 people into work, 750 into education. So I suppose at the heart, that model complements our commercial model such that we're able to deliver an economic, environmental and a social return to the folks who we buy that supply chain surplus from.
It is a fantastic model. I've been to see it in Athersea and Barnsley, which was fantastic. Anna, I'm coming to you, I suppose, partly as an expert on food and the food system. And as running the Peace Please programme, which we're very proud to be part of. I suppose we have 2 questions, really. Firstly, your reflections on where the convenience store market is now in terms of food and healthy food provision, perhaps relating to what Gary and Mittal have said. And I suppose, secondly, I'm going to treat you a little bit as a spokesperson of the government, which, of course, you're not in any way, but to talk about maybe some of the challenges in terms of regulation that could be considered, at least, in relation to our sector. So, firstly, where's the sector now in terms of food provision?
Well, I think, first of all, it's great to be here, and thank you for having me, and great to be with such a great group of panellists. I think probably there's one key point I wanted to make, really, about the convenience sector, and it sort of links, really, to what Gary was saying, and that's that we know from... We've done quite a lot of sort of detailed analysis around using government data around... dietary inequality, so who gets a good diet, who doesn't get a good diet in the UK, and particularly the situation for children. And we do see that amongst the children who are at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, those households that those kids are living in are more dependent on convenience stores than other sectors of the population. So we know that you guys have a really, really critical role in trying to help those families to get a good diet. And I think, that's really linked into where we are on the Peas Please conversation. This is really a national initiative to try and help everyone eat a bit more veg by doing all different things across the food system. And we've got 60 or so businesses who have now made pledges to do that. And I think, and also the work that you're doing on Healthy Start in actually making the fact that you accept those vouchers really visible, making sure that you do accept them and that your customers can buy fruit and veg with them. They're all really important steps which the local shop can do to help families go on that journey towards healthier eating. And we've got a pretty, as I'm sure you all know, quite drastic situation with our diets and our kids' diets in particular at the moment. And that's got sort of 2 angles. One, of course, is their health. We've got now, children who are getting into adolescence and already being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. That would be a disease that typically wouldn't happen till you're much later in life. And then those kids are going to accumulate, as they get into adulthood, a whole range of health problems, which bring a huge amount of personal suffering. So there's the health story, but then, of course, there's the environmental story as well. We know that our food system carries with it a massive footprint on the environment, whether it's through the greenhouse gas emissions back to Extinction Rebellion or the impact on biodiversity. And so there's a kind of a role that we can all play in helping everyone go on that journey towards a slightly healthier and a slightly more sustainable diet. And I think, you have a particularly important part to play given your clientele.
Ranvi, I'm talking to you also as a voice of the consumer in terms of the work you do in the media and so on, and the number of conversations you have with consumers and families about diet choices and so on. There's a lot to unpack, as Chris said, in terms of you've got food waste, we've got issues around packaging, and we've got issues around health as well. How do you feel that consumers are feeling about the balance of this? Is there a trade-off, or are they all something we can pursue together? And where are we sitting this as convenience stores?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because when we've been doing Eat Shop Safe for 3 years, we're going to start again next year, but what's always there seems to be a trend in the families that we have on our show, and they're all sort of working class families really that we have on our show in general, and I feel like to still say working class, I don't know, but anyway, and they tend to try to do their best to do the best big shop they can on the weekend. But because of time pressure, they're tired, everybody's coming in at different times, and by sort of Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, some of the food that they've bought at the weekend is never going to be used again. So it ends up in the bin. And some, you know, parents do want the best and try to, you know, buy some fruit, buy some veg. But in the end, by Wednesday, everyone's a bit tired. And by Wednesday evening, certainly all the good intentions of the weekend of what we're going to eat this week have gone. And what ends up happening is, and we always discover this, is that the top-up shop at your local convenience store is an enormous part of how families manage what their kids are going to eat during the week. It's an enormous part of it. And I think, obviously, not all local stores can have any fresh produce in it, because obviously it's stock that goes to waste if nobody buys it, and it looks horrible if it, you know what I mean, you don't want moldy onions as you open the door in your, you know, your local convenience shop or whatever. But what I've also found is that once you get under the skin of what's actually going on in families, that we talk about pester power from children, and we often think that's to do with, oh, I want that toy with the Happy Meal. But actually, I think what local convenience stores, because if you think about the pattern of how people, that families are using local convenience stores as their big top-up shop in the middle of the week, is that the pester power, because in schools, in all schools, all kids are now learning about five a day and what's healthy. There is a massive curriculum change. There's loads of pressure. Environmental things. Kids are absorbing all of this, and they are becoming agents in their own right. You can see, you know, you see what's happened with Greta Thunberg, you know. That sort of thing will have an impact on how children... When we go into people's houses, whenever I do that, we do these secret interviews, you know, away from each other so they can all tell the truth. And it is the children who really want change. They don't want to be eating the same coloured food all week. They would like a variety. They do want something a bit more healthy. And it is in, because I think we can tap into that. As local, you think you're giving the kids what they want, but actually they are interested in the environment. They are wanting to be healthier. They understand about their health and well-being much more than I did when I was younger. So local convenience stores can certainly, I think, actually make quite a lead in tapping into what young primary school children even, how they feel differently now, actually.
It's a really interesting angle. Yeah, and Garen, I'll come to you actually. I should say as well, we've got a couple of microphones in there. If anyone wants to make a point, you've got some questions coming through on Twitter, so that's working, that's great. And if anyone wants to ask a question, put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you. But Gary, having seen the site in Atherton, picking up on what Ramble, everyone's been saying really about families and how it's one thing buying the product, it's then using it and skills in terms of cooking and so on. How does the sort of cafe and cooking element link to the retail element and community shop?
Well, we've certainly got more knowledge, obviously, in the community shop part of our business and in company shop part of our business, because we've got a chef and people on site. So 71% of our sales in our community shops are fresh fruit and vegetables and raw protein. So, you know, people aren't coming in for stuff that they can bang in a microwave or come out of the freezer. People are coming in to buy items that they can cook. I'm not sure from our experience or from research that it's necessarily a skills deficit. That somehow there's a magical property to low-income consumers that they're too stupid to cut an onion. I don't believe that that's true. And certainly if you look at Canada, where they've done a lot of research around people's food skill and food ability, that isn't the truth. So it isn't that we have a different level of skill, particularly in our lower-income communities. But there is a level of confidence and risk. So if you're thinking to yourself, I might have a crack at celeriac, but you don't really know what it is, and you don't know whether the kids will like it, then you've got to expose yourself to a huge level of financial risk if it's been £1.80. And our average basket spends £8.42. So, you know, in the lowest income consumer bracket, people haven't got £1.80 to splash out on a celeriac. So we're quite creative in the way that we position that fruit and veg offer, selling much smaller units. We do a discount on it because we're a social enterprise. So that's kind of in our gift to model our P&L a bit differently about our stock range. But also we do a lot of work, I suppose, curating those products. We use, if we've got aubergine or whatever it is, we've got plenty in because we buy supply chain surplus, so it's not quite so easy for us. then we'll do two or three dishes in the cafe on the same day with that product. And we'll do a giveaway of a recipe. And in the afternoon after lunch, we'll do a chef demo where you can get involved and do something. So I think, and I think it's really interesting. I was listening to your stuff about coffee and pop-up restaurants and that idea that I don't really think anybody has a monopoly on doing good. I don't think one particular business model has a monopoly on doing good. And a lot of the stores that are represented here today are community hubs.
Of course.
And do create a space of interaction for people around food, which can be leveraged not only for social good, but actually for business good at the same time. And I don't think the two are exclusive. Yeah. So I don't think it's about skill deficit. I think it's about people taking a risk with a product that if it goes wrong, you haven't got enough money left to get you to the end of the week.
Absolutely. And Mittal, where's health sit in terms of the decisions you're making around, well, store in Mustard, store in Northern Quarter, store in Stretford? Where does that consideration sit for you and your customers?
Well, I'm glad Gary's mentioned money because cost is a huge barrier to experimenting with loose and even vegan and gluten-free products. And believe it or not, vegan food is more expensive than mass-produced meat products. And to stock it is a huge burden for us. And you've really got to either go in hard and do everything and really show yourself as a destination. And then people get to know. And equally, what we found is once people find out that you stock these products, you almost become a symbol of, like, well, that's a beacon, you know, you're a destination. So all I've ever known is that if something interests me and I can clock that, you know, the general public have an interest in it too, we react. And that's our opportunity, is to be reactive and quick to trying to fix problems, but also provide a product which people are after. And equally, you know, what we also found is you can put a range in, but immediately you'll get a feedback to say, well, why don't you do this version of that product and this version of that product? And it's really exciting to sort of know that there's an opportunity for, you mentioned Twitter, so communication, you know, we get DMs and we get social media DMs all the time, you know, can you get this, can you get that, and when are they coming back in? And that's our opportunity, really, to work with them and make sure we deliver.
So, Anna, lots of issues around this. What's the right approach to trying to improve generally the nation's health and diet, but I suppose particularly thinking about convenience stores? To what extent, how much is stick, how much is carrots? Probably not an appropriate thing to use when talking about, but carrots are a very appropriate thing to talk about in this context. What's the right balance between incentives and regulation, if you like?
Well, I think it's a really difficult area of policy, and I don't know if any of you have been following the process of developing this national food strategy, which Henry Dimbleby is currently leading, and that I'm quite involved in that process, and there's a lot of really difficult policy challenges. And some of those things are, so if we look, you know, calorie for calorie, for example, unhealthy calories are three times cheaper than healthy calories, right? So you've got a kind of skewing. If you've not got much money in your pocket and you want to just fill up the kids, you're going to end up often with quite calorific food that's cheap but doesn't really have a lot of other nutrients in it. So you've got a price barrier. When you look at advertising and promotions, it's also heavily skewed in favour. And you will know better than I all of the reasons why it all stacks up in that way in terms of the food system. And the job, I think, of government at this point is to try and think about the future food system that we want and how they can try and shape and incentivize it in a way which delivers a slightly better outcome, which is good for everybody, good for businesses, but also good for citizens in terms of health and then ultimately the environment. So, I mean, I think, but we have to take citizens with us, obviously, on that journey. And as Ranveer said, many of them are ready and up for that journey, kids in particular. But this isn't something that's going to kind of instantly switch. Mm-hmm. So I think that the process of, I mean, I would really encourage you, for example, to submit your ideas to the call for evidence for the National Food Strategy. It closes on the 25th of October, I think. And you've got very much direct contact with your customers in a way which many other retailers don't have. And you'll have those insights and how you can actually work with your customers to go on that journey together. Mm-hmm. So I would really encourage you to kind of put your ideas into that. I think it is a complicated mix of getting businesses to show leadership, because policy can't solve everything. Inspiring citizens, and in fact we've been partnering with ITV on the Big Veg Power Eat Them to Defeat Them campaign, which has been really successful and is one way of getting kids excited about eating veg. But then also some of the other ways in which government can regulate, whether it's through fiscal policies and the other measures that they have at their disposal, going right back to, you know, how we support our farmers and what the right mix of things are to support what we grow in the UK. So it's right the way up the supply chain. It is a complicated mix, but I think we're really now at the point where everybody needs to jump in and try and shape this in a good way so we build a common vision for the food system we want.
And Bram, we're asking you to put your political hat on a little bit now again. What do you think the appetite is in government for real interventions in this area, really sort of strong policies, particularly things that might bother us? So things like sighting restrictions in store, you can only put certain products in certain places. What's the appetite?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Dame Sally Davies is leaving at the moment as the chief medical health officer, and she's, you know, said that we are woefully behind on this 2030 aim of reducing childhood obesity. She came up with, don't eat on public transport. You know, it was a slightly desperate attempt to sort of say we have to do something drastic. I think that, in the current political situation, it's incredibly difficult, to get any message across about what's important because everybody is clouded by a single issue. But it was interesting, what you were talking there about sort of, how the skills deficit and whether people, can cook and things like that with the food that they've got. What we did on Eat Shop Save, which we always find, is that, many, many people believe that they can't go for the health thing, A, because it's more expensive or because it's fresh produce and they don't know what. But we always tell our families and therefore our millions of viewers is that it's not always fresh. So in your local community, you can have loads of frozen vegetables and they are just or as tins, healthy. Yeah. And local convenience stores can really promote that
definitely.
As being, it's not the second best option, it is the best option. Tinned vegetables and frozen vegetables, you don't have to have stock that's going off in buckets, in crates, that then is wasted food. It can be in your freezer. And also this idea of batch cooking, encouraging people to, cook, like you said, in your community, encouraging people to cook three or four different meals out of what you can get from your local store and then freezing them, and therefore during the week you go to what's in your freezer, but it's healthy stuff that's in the freezer. So you're saving money and you're also eating healthier throughout the week. And, I don't know where local convenience stores come into that, but it is possibly, you think loads of people do loyalty schemes and things like that, in all coffee shops do. There's nothing to stop local convenience stores from doing, with their kid, with your kids,
absolutely,
or having a special, you say, where should food be placed? You could have a stall that is a site that is, these are your healthy treats this week, kids, and you get a stamp every time you get one of them, or, just something to encourage kids when they go in.
Yeah, I'm laughing. So Anita, Nye at the front, who I've been trying to persuade to put a hand up, but do you want to tell the story, Anita, about what you're doing with the food stamp, with the stamps? We'll get a microphone to you, so.
Thank you. So I'm Anita and I've got a premier store in Orpington. So basically what it was, we have a junior school at the end of our road, we have a senior school, and we were seeing more and more that the parents and the children were coming into the store every morning and just panicking because it was getting to the point where the schools were taking stuff out of their packed lunch boxes because they're saying they weren't eating the right stuff. So we did actually start giving away free fruit three times a week to primary school kids because some of them hadn't even seen an apple, didn't even know what it tastes like. But as it was getting more and more and they were saying about the packed lunches, I took it upon myself. I started up a child's loyalty card. It's called the Snack Smart Club. And basically what it is, all the children in primary school age were given one of these cards. We got some of the suppliers to give us some free stock and when we launched it. And basically what it is, they get their loyalty card. They have to come in. They have to buy a snack. It has to be under 100 calories. It cannot be chocolate or sweet-based. We sell the fruit, the bags, apple bags and things like that. And they get a stamp each time they come in. And then when they've got 10 stamps, they can come in the shop, they can choose a little, we have pens, pencils, they can take a free snack with them. But it makes them feel important because they feel all grown up because they've got their loyalty card. We got the school involved. We asked them to come in and okay everything that we were selling. that it would be approved for their lunchboxes. And also there was a child's family centre, so they advertised for us, and a couple of nurseries in the area as well. So we've been doing that just over a year now.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Fantastic. It shows these very local initiatives developed with the school in those areas, that there is an appetite to that. And I guess also the enthusiasm of the kids, exactly what you were saying about that.
And it makes it a destination, like you were saying, Mittal. Yeah. You know, it makes it a destination as well.
Yeah. Amazing. So I'll ask a final question to everyone in a second. Firstly, one specifically to Mittal, though. We're talking very positively, lots of lovely things. But what are the risks? What are the negatives? Because there's a reason why. You know, there are lots of challenges in offering fresh produce generally, in particular, and healthy food more widely. What are some of those challenges? How might you get over them as a retailer?
To food waste in particular?
Well, waste is one of them, yeah.
I think you, as a retailer, you've got to be brave and you've got to find the courage to stock and to bring those products to your shelves. Risk is always, there's always going to be cost. Our margins are constantly eaten away at, whether it's legislation, whether it's the banks closing down and the post office doing whatever they're doing with their commissions. There's every which way you look at an operation in convenience stores, for me, I feel we're being chipped away at. And the traditional view of a convenience store from my parents' operation to what it is today, I believe has completely been flipped on its head. And you need to flip it on its head. I've just written down Anita's initiative, and I'm going to copy it, to be honest. And I think, you know, inspiration, innovation is there around you, and it's up to you whether you walk around blind or whether you decide to open your eyes and your mind. When I've got two kids, so what you've just said there is strikes a chord with me, and I'm doing whatever I can to educate my kids and set them challenges and set them targets to hit and for them to work out their path in their lives. And I think the biggest problem we have is a generational problem. You could argue about kids being the sort of the catalyst to change, but you know, you're going to get people in society who are stuck with parents who probably don't understand what they need to do. But over time, I think we're going to be forced into a situation. You know, Extinction Rebellion's happening. There's all sorts happening around us. I mean, it's just a matter of time before, if you don't make changes into your business, and actually if you don't put your own foot forward, you're just going to get left behind. And I don't think you can blame competition then at that point.
Sure. I'm going to get down the line from this end and finish up with Ranveer. I'm going to ask a question, but you can answer another one if you want. But I suppose the question I want to ask, because it came from the audience, is a good question. So someone answer it, please. But is providing a decent choice in convenience stores enough in terms of what our obligations are, the right thing commercially, and enough to stop more regulation coming down the line in this space? So is that what we should be focused on, providing an informed choice to consumers? Should we be doing something more? Gary, I've got to start with you.
I think you should be doing more. It's probably not the answer to the question, but I was just thinking about it. And I was just reflecting on some of the things that I've heard there. I think absolutely that's part of it. When we developed Community Shop, we used a model, an international model, that's called asset-based community development. I'm not going to go on about that, but lots of people who do good stuff in low-income communities use a deficit-based model. There are people who are poor, who are kids of truancy, they're using drugs and they've got bad housing. So we'll focus on all the bad things and then we'll go and fix all the bad things. It's a really poor model. The asset-based development model says whatever community you go in, it's probably got more strengths than it's got weaknesses. And so if you focus on what's strong and not what's wrong, then you'll probably get different outcomes.
Yeah.
You probably get better outcomes. And one of the things that I think fascinates me at the moment in this sector is that there is so much about the convenience sector which is hugely strong. So shortening those supply chains so that the space between where the food's produced and the person who gets it is a little bit shorter. The stuff around sustainability, about dynamic ability to respond to customers' needs, are incredible strengths. And also understanding that just because somebody else has created a dominant retail model for the last 30 years doesn't mean that we can't do something different.
Sure.
We can't be something different within our communities. Last night I live in Garforth outside Leeds, and as a little sideline, I own a deli. And we had a meeting with some of the local suppliers, some of the local retailers, many of whom will be here, and some of the local community growing groups. to do two things, to work out how we could get the growing groups to grow more herbs and veg on the high street outside our stores so that people could pick it for free as they wandered along, and to understand how we could operate a concierge service so that those of us who are daft who are open 7 days a week and long hours can be a pick-up and drop-off point for the great artisan bread, for the local meat, for the local fruit and veg, through a dead simple app-based service which drives people into our deli to pick up the concierge stuff that they can't buy because those other shops have closed, and then to up my basket spend by £3.12 because they just came in anyway. So I think there are all sorts of positive, strong things. And I think if you think that just offering choice and informed choice is the breadth of the vision, you'll miss out on some banging opportunities to be more.
It's a great message. Anna, is choice enough?
That is a great message. Choice, I don't think, is enough. I think the thing about choice, you go into a lot of stores and you have a huge choice. But when you actually look at whether that is an equal choice between a healthier or more sustainable product and an it's not. It's all stacked against us. And so when you're thinking about choice, think about how you really make that a balanced, you know, an equal choice between healthier and unhealthier foods in reality for customers, where you put them, what, how their price point, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think I totally agree. I mean, Anita has shown the way with innovating. Like, what can you do to be actually taking your customers on this journey, doing something different, building on all the brilliant points that, that Gary just made? But I think you're all potential leaders in trying to move us all on this journey, and I would say seize that opportunity.
Mittal.
Is choice good?
Is choice enough?
Is choice enough?
Is that your responsibility when you go into a store and set up a store? Is it about providing an informed choice to people, or do you have to be more active in trying to push people towards an outcome?
For years we've been told less is more, and I think, again, that's being flipped on its head. I think less. I mean, how many tins of baked beans can you sell? I mean, you're going to have Heinz and you're going to have an own label potentially. And that traditional view of groceries is still around. It will always work. And but for me, it's how you add on to that. So we might do branded bread and an own label bread, but the local baker doing his sourdough and his focaccias and his ciabattas or whatever, you know, if you don't do that, you know, you're missing the trick completely. Mm-hmm. And for me, choice is very interesting, because choice can mean a lot of things, actually, and it's how you interpret it. And for me, it's my choice, and the reason you'd come to me is because I've chosen to shop local with my supply chain. So I have a national supply chain, which we tick all the boxes with, again, through choice. But we also add a huge bonus to that, where we work with so many different people, and a big buzzword for me in my business is collaboration. Mm-hmm. And through collaboration, we have choice.
Brilliant. Ravi, you have the last word.
Well, I mean, I can't really talk about, you know, your industry because I'm not in it. But, you know, if you look at, you know, my industry, you were saying, Anna, you've been working with ITV. You know, the act has always been above commercial television, particularly ITV, because it's the biggest sort of channel for families, if you like, is a banning of junk food advertising before the watershed. Now, that in a commercial sense would be horrendous for a commercial channel. And so whether it's, and it's the same, you're talking about whether regulation will force change or whether you make the change before the regulation comes to force you to make the change. So ITV for the last few years have had a massive push on consumer-led healthy eating. Like, that's where my program Eat Shop Safe came out of, was mm-hmm. the desire to do more. The Tonight program does so much about diet and healthy eating and all of that. So now the channel, because it makes sense, because otherwise regulation will come in, because if the junk food banning junk food advertising comes in, it will hugely damage the profits of a channel. And so we have to prove that we are doing the right thing. So is it enough to offer choice in TV programmes, or do you have to make much more of an effort in offering programmes that the central thread is about mm-hmm. making healthier choices, reducing obesity, reducing type 2 diabetes, and that is essentially what ITV is doing now in a big way. Mm-hmm. So I can only reflect it on my own industry.
Sure. There's quite a lot of parallels.
There are parallels in that if you don't make changes, policy will eventually come to bite you.
Fantastic. Really great discussion. Thanks very much to the panel. Thanks very much to Anita as well for that fantastic example. So please thank the panel.